From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents A Conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for January 10th, 2016. Thanks again for joining me this morning as we take our weekly look at the politics of the last week and what's on tap in the days ahead. And yes, it's time to grab the Sunday paper, that hot cup of coffee. Trust me, you're going to need it this morning. And we'll try to get your week started off on a good, if not warm, note. Well, Dave, I was just out on the WGN Weather Center patio, and those winds are really rocketing through.
Northwest in the 20-some miles an hour and gusting up to 30, you're going to feel it.
Oh, yeah. And I will, you know, frankly, the wind this morning getting up on the way over here, to say it was refreshing would be to be complimentary when I don't mean it that way.
Yeah, we have to look at it this way, though. You know, we didn't get all of the precipitation, the snow and the sleet and the rain that they were talking about. You know, yesterday afternoon, I thought we were going to get hit with some stuff, but it just kind of went away overnight.
I mean, there were times downtown yesterday afternoon when you could almost see somebody had flipped a switch, and it had gone from rain and starting a little bit like sleet.
Yeah.
But then the switch got flipped back again. And I kept waiting for the snow. And I know out in the northwest suburbs they got snow.
Yes, they did.
And yeah. But downtown, I think maybe we got saved by the lake or something.
Could be. I'm not real sure what might have happened. We'll have Mike Hammernick on later this morning, I hope, and he can certainly talk about it. But once again, as I mentioned in the newscast, Rick, there are some slick spots out there because, you know, the rain or snow that was the moisture on the roadways has frozen, certainly.
Oh, yeah, and that was kind of my fear, is even though maybe the snow didn't come, it was the fact that these frigid temperatures –
right,
are really going to ice things down and ice things over. So
yeah,
and so be careful, as Dave advised, on those roadways out there. And it was as kind of ugly as yesterday was, and boy, it did nothing for my mood to try to wake me up.
Oh. That probably not only makes two of us, but a bunch of us.
Yeah, I mean, at 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon, I swear it was 8:30 at night.
Oh, I know.
And, of course, part of my tiredness was because on Friday night, I went to my first Blackhawks game of the new year, and it was my first game since the opening puck drop, the banner night at the United Center. And
that's a long stretch for you.
Yes, it was. Well, I mean, things have been busy, but
they're going to get busier.
Yes, yes, they are. But I was able to take my daughters, and thanks to folks here and some friends, I actually had two seats on the glass.
Wow.
Okay, and I have to tell you, in all my years of hockey and going to games and things, I've never sat on the glass before. And wow. Now, if you're a purist, you do kind of want to sit up higher because you can see the
look
plays.
Look down on the action.
You can see the plays kind of develop better.
Right.
But still, there is nothing. And we were by one of the face-off circles, so kind of on the curve. And you hear the puck slamming into the boards, this large thunk noise.
Yeah.
You feel the boards giving when the guys are getting checked into them. There was a little ledge, and of course, that's how I was a rookie, because I, of course, set my Diet Coke on the ledge, and soon I was wearing that Diet Coke after a big check into the boards. But it reminded me back of when you'd play, because you hear all of those kind of popping thud noises, and that's also part of what lets the players know where the puck is, you know, and things like that. And it took me way back in time. And it was such a great victory, 3-1 over Buffalo. And, of course, that was six games in a row now that the Blackhawks have won. And tonight we go for number 7. And we'll have John and Troy will have all the action at 6 o'clock.
Colorado tonight.
Colorado Avalanche.
Yeah.
And then Tuesday night, I think I'm going to be back at the United Center to see the Hawks take on Nashville. So far, the New
will
Year's okay.
Will you have
okay.
your preferred seats at that time?
No, I will not be on the boards at that time. But nevertheless, it was very good. And my youngest daughter, Kate, who's the senior at Mizzou, brought her girlfriend from Mizzou, who was actually studying sports broadcasting. And it was Kaylee's first ever hockey game attending in person. And so they each got a chance to sit down by the
Well, that's pretty
glass.
Exciting.
Well, and I said, you know, this is probably the wrong way to do this because you will never, ever get seats like this ever again. You will be very, very spoiled by that. But and of course, now we got a big day of football ahead after yesterday. And I couldn't make it all the way through the Pittsburgh Bengals Cincinnati game. And you know, you talk about two teams that hate each other. I mean, really hate each other. And they play twice during the regular season, and then they play for the playoff spot, wild card spot yesterday. And it was very evident that it was going to turn ugly. And you had one, I think it was one Steelers coach ended up with, like, on the sideline play, ended up pulling the hair off one of those defensive backs with long braids. I mean, it was...
I saw that clip of it, a video clip of it, yeah.
And apparently, so the Bengals went up with like a minute and a half left, and they had the ball, and they were just going to run out the clock, and a Steeler guy stripped the ball.
Yep.
Pittsburgh recovers on the 9. Roethlisberger's shoulder is basically broken. He can't throw, but he gets the ball to midfield. And then you have the Bengals commit back-to-back stupid unsportsmanlike conduct plays that puts Pittsburgh in field goal range, and they win 18-16.
18-16, final score there. Yeah.
So the, you know, you talk about we often talk about politicians who self-destruct, but boy, there was a whole football team that just kind of self-destructed.
So today we have Seattle in Minnesota,
yeah,
and Green Bay at Washington later in the afternoon.
And that'll be Seattle-Minnesota's the early game.
Right,
I
noon.
Think around, yeah. Well, actually, I think it's even 11:30.
Is it 11:30?
Yeah,
okay.
Because they're special timing because they've got the Packers game right on afterward.
Oh, and they don't want to join that in progress.
Right. So, but it's supposed to be very cold up in the Twin Cities today, and that's outdoor stadium.
Well, given what it is here right now.
Yeah, so they were kind of talking like this could be a new ice bowl up there in Minnesota today with Seattle, but Seattle's still favored. And then the game afterwards, so the Washington versus the Packers, and that's kind of like a toss-up from what I understand, is they've been saying that that my friends out in D.C. are saying they're very concerned about this game. But, you know... Interesting. Here we are. We've got two playoff games that we're watching two of our divisional rivals play in. And what do? Who do we root for?
Yeah, that's a good question. And speaking of the weather in Minneapolis, you think it's cold here?
Uh-huh.
You ready for this?
Go for it.
It is 9 below in Minneapolis right now.
Yeah. And, well, I guess that would be Vikings football weather. I don't know about that, but
I don't know about Seattle.
So, but if somebody gave you tickets for that game, Dave,
I have bundled up at Bears games in the past, but not at 9 below.
Oh no, I can't imagine that. I just, I mean, yeah, I like football, but I wouldn't even go to like an outdoor. Well, and of course the Hawks are supposed to play a Winter Classic outdoor game in Minnesota this year, later this month, in fact. Which, can you imagine playing in that kind of cold?
9 below?
Yeah.
No, I can't.
Oh, I mean, I think you'd almost be afraid to take a shot with your stick because it would feel like that cold sting of a bat in the spring.
Vibration of the stick would just come right back at you, sure.
Oh, man. Well, it's a great day for if you're a sports fan. You got football starting at 11:30, two games, and then you roll right into the Blackhawks at 6 o'clock tonight.
Yep. So, not to mention some basketball too.
That's
college
right.
Basketball.
College hoops.
Purdue
going
at
on.
Illinois, and UIC plays Oakland. So yeah, we got everything.
All right. Well,
except baseball.
Yeah, well, if you want to go out to try some softball today, you text me how that goes, okay?
I'm going to have to do my countdown to spring training here in a few weeks just to give us a positive attitude about getting through the dead of winter.
You come off the high of the holidays, and then you go into the frigid freezer of January.
Yeah, and then all that played into yesterday. You know, the dismal feeling of everything.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news and traffic, as well as the weather this morning. Producer Jasmine is fielding your phone calls, and you can reach us at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at 312-981-7200. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin, and on Twitter @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is finishing off the last of the Coq au Vin I made for New Year's Eve. Just a reminder, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com, all of our past shows, or if you've got to switch away this morning, you can find the rest of the show there. You can also get our podcasts at iTunes by searching Rick Pearson. Coming up, we've got a great show today. After Dave brings us the 7:30 news, my good friend and colleague Blair Kamen, the Tribune's Pulitzer Prize-winning architectural critic, will join us, and we'll talk about the architect selection process for the new Obama Presidential Library. After the 8 o'clock news update from Dave, another Tribune colleague joins the show. Bill Ruthart, part of our political team, will be on to discuss the latest travails of Mayor Rahm Emanuel, including his flip-flop on an investigation of the city's law department. And then, speaking of sports, after the 8:30 news update, State Representative Mike Zalewski, a Riverside Democrat, joins the show. The representative is sponsoring legislation to make clear the legality of fantasy sports betting. That's all coming up ahead. We're going to take a quick break. This is the Sunday Spin. I used to smoke 5-pack of cigarettes a day. It was the hardest thing to put them away. I drank 4 or 5 bottles of wine. I kept a glass in my hand all the time. Oh, breaking those habits was hard to do. That's the great Otis Clay, who passed away Friday in Chicago after a heart attack. Clay was 73. Blues legend, soul singer, Blues Hall of Fame inductee. Just, you got to love it. That music is just amazing. Time now for our spin through national political news. And, of course, on Tuesday night, President Obama delivers his last State of the Union address. The president expected to tout his accomplishments rather than launch any grandiose programs that he wants to get through the Republican-led Congress. We're also moving closer to Iowa caucus day on February 1st, and the political ad wars are really heating up. Donald Trump launched his first TV ad, playing off fears of terrorism and illegal immigration.
The politicians can pretend it's something else, but Donald Trump calls it radical Islamic terrorism. That's why he's calling for a temporary shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until we can figure out what's going on. He'll quickly cut the head off ISIS and take their oil. And he'll stop illegal immigration by building a wall on our southern border that Mexico will pay for.
We will make America great again.
Yes, that's the Donald Trump ad. And, of course, he came in for some criticism from this ad. There's a scene in it which shows people crossing the border almost like ants. The ad makes it sound, as you heard, like it's the U.S. border with Mexico. It's actually footage from Morocco in northern Africa. Trump, of course, also facing some criticism for the removal of a Muslim woman who attended a rally. And some of the people attending there were not very kind in showing their displeasure of her having shown up. She said she just wanted to go there to show Donald Trump what a Muslim is like, since Donald wants to stop any Muslim immigration. Trump's also brought back his birther shtick, this time questioning whether rival Ted Cruz, the Texas senator, could be president, since he was born in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, to a Cuban father and a U.S.-born mother.
People are worried that if he weren't born in this country, which he wasn't, he was born in Canada. The problem is that if the Democrats bring a lawsuit, the lawsuit could take years to resolve. And how do you have a candidate where there's something, you know, over the head of the party and that individual?
While Trump stirred that up, Cruz was also forced to play some defense, even though virtually all legal authorities say Cruz is eligible to be president. Cruz used a new ad to say that Republicans need to get back to their principles.
Barack Obama sticks by his principles. It's time for Republicans to stand by ours. That's how we win. And that's how I'll lead. As president, I won't compromise the values that make us who we are. The Constitution wasn't a first draft. Our border isn't a revolving door. And the rule of law wasn't meant to be broken. America is off track, but our founding principles will get us back.
Now, Cruz, the front runner, early front runner right now in Iowa, having overtaken Donald Trump, he's coming in for a lot of criticism from all fronts. Long shot Rick Santorum, looking for help for his campaign, joining others and going after Cruz by mocking him. Santorum won Iowa four years ago and is a former Pennsylvania senator.
I like green eggs and ham.
Ted Cruz is wonderful at reading children's fairy tales on the Senate floor.
Sam, I am.
Rick Santorum spent his time in the Senate a little differently. 8 years on the Senate Armed Services Committee, helping to modernize today's Army to better be prepared for today's threats. Santorum also wrote and passed tough laws, putting harsh sanctions on Iran. And for more than a decade, Rick Santorum has been a leader taking on radical Islam.
Not all Muslims are jihadists, and no one would say that. But the reality is, all jihadists are Muslims.
You want someone to read one hell of a bedtime story? Ted Cruz is your guy. If you want to protect America and defeat ISIS, Rick Santorum's your president. Because serious times need serious people.
Meanwhile, Rand Paul, the Kentucky Republican senator, is also seeing his presidential bid struggling. Now, we talked last week on this show with my friend Robin Johnson about Rand Paul reaching out to millennials. Well, here's a portion of an ad that Paul is using to try to reach out to younger voters.
What if I told you your vote makes a difference?
What if I said it's possible to force the nation to listen?
What if we made it our mission to flood the polls on February 1st?
Show the world what the youth vote is worth.
What if this election season marks the rebirth of student activism?
What if the millennial moment has arisen?
What if I told you the future of our country rests on your decision
to elect the only candidate with a liberty-centered vision?
The only candidate that stands tirelessly for you.
He came with an open heart, ready to listen.
The only candidate who isn't blindly leading us to world war.
I have a lot of family members that are locked up, and no other politician is standing up and fighting for those individuals.
I stand with Rand because Rand stands with us.
Rand Paul needs you.
10,000 high school students,
college students,
Iowa youth, the grassroots,
caucus for truth,
and prove once and for all that the youth vote does matter.
A very key component for Rand Paul's campaign. Florida Senator Marco Rubio also is reaching out, this time to evangelical Republicans in Iowa, as he tries to make a big finish in the nation's first caucus state.
Our goal is eternity, the ability to live alongside our Creator for all time, to accept the free gift of salvation offered to us by Jesus Christ. The struggle on a daily basis as a Christian is to remind ourselves of this. The purpose of our life is to cooperate with God's plan. To those who much has been given, much is expected, and we will be asked to account for that. Were your treasures stored up on earth or in heaven? And to me, I try to allow that to influence me in everything that I do.
Interesting how these candidates appealing to various swatches of the electorate. Ohio Republican Governor John Kasich, who's making moves in New Hampshire, he also launched a new ad, seemingly aimed at Donald Trump trying to badmouth the United States.
He lived a hard scrabble life in a rusty steel town. John Kasich never gives up. When he lost his parents to a drunk driver, he had the faith to carry on. Some said he couldn't balance the federal budget, but Kasich stunned Washington. They said he couldn't save Ohio from an $8 billion shortfall, but Kasich did. They say our best days are behind us. America, never give up.
There's your John Kasich ad. It's 7:28 in the morning. We're going to take a quick break. This is the Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I got a note from my friend Rick, who's part of the Chicago City Street Crew. And despite the lack of snow, the Snow Patrol has been up and had it for the last several hours. So at least we know that the streets are getting salted, and hopefully some of those frozen spots will absorb some of that salt and make our travel a little bit easier today. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, Blair Kamen, national award-winning architectural critic for the Chicago Tribune.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Last week, the president made some took some executive actions on guns. Nothing very dramatic that he can do, wanting stiffer regulation of background checks, but he spoke to the nation about his concern over gun violence, and of course, Chicago played a very prominent role in his discussions. Here's the president in an emotional moment.
First graders. And from every family who never imagined that their loved one would be taken from our lives by a bullet from a gun. Every time I think about those kids, it gets me mad. And by the way, it happens on the streets of Chicago every day. So, all of us need to demand a Congress brave enough to stand up to the gun lobby's lies. All of us need to stand up and protect its citizens. All of us need to demand governors and legislators and businesses do their part to make our communities safer.
That was the president last week, and of course, I think you will hear more about the issue of guns when the president delivers his last State of the Union address on Tuesday in Washington. Well, joining me now is my good friend and colleague at the Chicago Tribune, the Chicago Tribune's nationally acclaimed architecture expert, Blair Kamen. Blair, thanks for getting up with me this morning.
Good morning, Rick. It's great to be with you.
You know, I tell you, I always enjoy your writing. Of course, I enjoy also listening to you over sitting in the QB not far from me sometimes, too, with some of these people. But before the holiday break, the Obama Presidential Library Foundation had made its selection of architects to apply to design this half-billion-dollar presidential center. And I kind of liked your take on this was, and I want to quote, it's tempting to characterize the list of seven finalists for the Obama Presidential Center as the greatest rout of Chicago architects by Easterners since the World's Columbian Exposition of 1893. And indeed, you know, when you go through the list of firms, there's one from Chicago.
Right.
And go ahead.
No, that was a disappointment to many in the Chicago architectural community. The firm selected is John Ronan Architects, a very good firm. Their works include the Poetry Foundation headquarters in River North and the Gary Comer Youth Center which incidentally is where the Obama Foundation announced in May that the Presidential Center would be built in Chicago. But nonetheless, the expectation was that there would be more, a greater number of Chicago architects among the seven finalists for this very prestigious commission. And it turned out that there were four from New York, two from Europe, and as we've said, only one from Chicago.
And of course, you know, the city's proud architectural heritage. But, you know, as you pointed out, none of these firms are anything, you know, to sneeze at. I mean, we've got, and maybe what we could do is if we can run down each of these firms, and maybe you can assess, you know, strength, weakness,
sure,
that kind of thing.
Sure. Well, the firms from overseas are David Adjaye, who is a London-based Tanzanian-born architect, who is the designer, the chief designer of the National Museum of African American Art and Culture, or History and Culture, I should say, in Washington. He had dined with the Obamas at a dinner, a state dinner for British Prime Minister David Cameron a few years ago, and that instantly started speculation that he would be a prime candidate for this job, and indeed he was. Another overseas architect is Renzo Piano from Italy. He is a winner of the Pritzker Architecture Prize, and his works include the Art Institute of Chicago's Modern Wing, which opened a few years ago. Michelle Obama attended the opening of Piano's Whitney Museum of American Art in New York last year. She raved about the building. She said that even the elevator, even the freight elevators were beautiful. So that it wasn't too much of a surprise that Renzo made.
Well, and as you noted, that Piano joined Obama at a Rome dinner.
That's right, for Italian notables. So now, not everybody who dined with Obama made the cut.
That's why I'm wondering if this has become a dinner selection.
Yeah. Helmut Jahn, for example, was being considered. He was present at a dinner for Angela Merkel at the White House, but he didn't make it. So that was not the only criteria, eating with the press. Two of the New York finalists. Oh, by the way, I should say, if either Adjaye or Piano wins the job, he would be the first foreign architect to design a U.S. presidential library. It's always been a U.S. architect in the past. Now there are four other New York finalists: Diller, Scofidio, and Renfro, a firm that co-designed the High Line in New York.
That's like our 606.
That's like our 606. That's a former elevated freight railway that's been converted into a hugely popular linear park in Lower Manhattan. Then there's Todd Williams, Billy Chen Architects. They have designed the Barnes Foundation, a wonderful art museum in Philadelphia, as well as the University of Chicago's Logan Center for the Arts, which is just a few blocks from where the Obama Center could be built. The other two New York firms are Shop Architects, whose works include the Barclays Center, the Arena in Brooklyn, and Snøhetta, a firm that was founded in Norway but has since moved its base to the United States, and its designs include the September 11th Museum in Lower Manhattan. So it's a very strong field.
And as you pointed out in the story I was referencing earlier, that, you know, we're talking about modernists. We're not talking about classicists.
Exactly. If there's a kind of taste culture evident here, it is modernist architects who favor sleek, clean-lined or strongly sculptural forms. It's very different from the architect who designed the George W. Bush Library, Robert A.M. Stern, a traditionalist. I mean, it's tempting to say that Democrats tend to like modernists, Republicans tend to like traditionalists, but that's a little too easy. It's not always that clear of a divide, but in general, there's some truth to that.
Well, are we looking, and of course, you know, this is still going to design phase, But our, you know, you tend to think of presidential libraries. There's always, and museums, there's the recreation of the Oval Office inside, those kinds of things. But they tend to be more of a stately type facility, like a government stately type facility.
Right. And the Obamas want something different from that. They have said they want a presidential center that engages the community, that has places for bold thinkers and people who are, involved with hatching new ideas.
Thinking outside the box.
Yeah, thinking outside the box. And this in some way reflects Barack Obama's background as a community organizer on the south side of Chicago. He doesn't want a presidential fortress, it would seem. He wants a building that engages the community. And I think that's very important, a very important aspiration, because these buildings or the Obama Center will be built in either Washington Park or Jackson Park. And the idea is really to engage the communities and uplift the communities around the center. Both are minority communities that have that are low income and have many of the problems associated with urban areas in Chicago. So the center is really seen as a kind of economic engine that will help to uplift these communities economically and otherwise.
We're speaking with Blair Kamen, my colleague at the Chicago Tribune, the national award-winning architectural critic. And we're talking about the architectural selection for the Obama Presidential Library. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson on this chilly Sunday morning in downtown Chicago. Joining me on the phone is Blair Kamen, my colleague, the Tribune's nationally renowned architectural critic. Blair, you touched on a couple of things right before the break there about, you know, trying to make sure that the Obama Presidential Library and Museum, Obama Presidential Center, ties into the community and that it not become kind of an isolation from the community. And you noted that it was kind of interesting that they've asked these seven architectural finalists to design conceptions for both of the potential sites.
Yeah, that's what's good about the design process at this point. They're not simply handing the architects a site and saying, here, you know, put an object on it. They're asking the architects for, as you said, conceptual designs for both Jackson and Washington Park. And this is important because the architects will have potentially at least an influence on where the Obamas decide to put the presidential center. And the sites are similar but different. Both Jackson and Washington Park were designed by Frederick Law Olmsted, a great American landscape architect of the 19th century. Both have about 20 acres in total size. The site, for the presidential library is about 20 acres within those parks, which are much larger. But Washington Park is different because it has an additional 11 acres outside the park's western border, and that's land between King Drive and the Chicago Transit Authority's Green Line. So some of the presidential center, at least, could be located outside Washington Park and could be more integrated with the city around it, tying directly to the Green Line and the neighborhood around it. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what the architects propose in terms of for the different sites. And that's crucial because it won't only help the Obamas pick a site. It will also help them to develop a relationship with the architect. That is really critical here. I mean, this is not just a fashion show where they pick a shape. They're picking an architect who designs a building that is supposed to be a full-fledged experience, something that you see on the outside, you move through on the inside, something that relates to the community, doesn't just sit there like a, you know, a grand temple of Obama. So I think the selection process so far is going pretty well.
Well, you also noted that each of these architects or architectural firms will have a sit down with the president and the first lady in
exactly,
this year ahead. But
yeah.
But you're hopeful that it's not just a one and done kind of thing.
Right. They're supposed to meet with the Obamas at the White House in the first quarter of 2016. I do hope that there's more than one meeting. Perhaps there will. And the reason being, again, is to establish a relationship between the clients and the architects. Perhaps there will be callbacks. In other words, they'll meet the architects and then, narrow it to the final three and have final interviews. But that's simply speculation on my part. I hope that, it's not just a one-and-done selection process, as you say.
Do you think there already is a preferred site between Jackson Park or Washington Park?
There was a lot of speculation among journalists last year that Washington Park was the pick. But I think that there isn't. I think that the selection process this selection process really does open the door and makes it a level playing field between Jackson and Washington. Jackson has advantages. It's near the Museum of Science and Industry. There could be shared parking with the Museum of Science and Industry's underground parking lot. It is near a metro stop. You could go directly from Millennium Park down Metro right to the Obama Library. It's also right near the lakefront, much closer to the lakefront than Washington. Conceivably, there could be an area at the top of the building, an office, where Barack Obama and Michelle Obama would have offices looking out over the waters of Lake Michigan, which is prime. That's the prime view in Chicago.
Yes, indeed.
So, I think that it's really an open question at this point, and neither Washington nor Jackson Park is the clear choice.
So how long do we expect this process to take?
We expect it to be resolved with a choice announced in mid-2016. So June, July, somewhere around there. There already have been some delays. But that's the timetable. And the building itself is supposed to start construction after Obama leaves office about a year from now, early 2017. And then it's supposed to open in 2020 or 2021.
But this seems like a very rapid moving process for these architectural firms.
Yeah, I think so. Yes and no. I think that, 6 months is probably enough time to, for them to have a deliberate selection process with enough time to really review their compatibility with the architectural firm and also look at their previous work and their conceptual proposals. So I think there's enough time here. I don't think it's not like a shotgun selection process. I think there's some room for deliberate thinking, which is what you'd expect from the former legal instructor at the University of Chicago.
Blair, one other thing I wanted to ask you about is the Chicago Architecture Biennial. And apparently it was so successful this past 2015 that it's coming back in 2017. I have to tell you, I don't know what that is.
Hey, you didn't read all my stories about the biennial?
I tried.
Oh, man, I'm sorry. Well, anyway, the Chicago Architecture Biennial just wrapped up. It was an exhibition headquartered at the Cultural Center across from Millennium Park, and it was an exhibition of cutting-edge work by about 120 architects and design firms from around the world, roughly from 30 countries. The idea of the exhibition was to explore what it called the state of the art of architecture, and that's a very kind of vague term. But what that essentially means is It was really kind of a think tank and exhibition combined that gave architects a chance to come up with proposals that showed what was important to them and also revealed how they might try to make the world a better place in very simple language. For example, Jeannie Gang, a very prominent Chicago architect, designed a proposal for reimagining a Chicago police station. Instead of having a police station that would be cut off from the community, surrounded by parking lots, her idea was to redevelop both the police station and the areas around it. So you would have a police station that had a gym nearby, a basketball court nearby, parks nearby. And the idea here was to address, through design, the lack of trust between officers and the people they police, and that has is said to have led to some of the many of the police shootings around the country. This proposal, interestingly, was hatched in October when the biennial started, long before the Laquan McDonald shooting raised
issue,
police brutality issues, you know, in to such a high level in Chicago. There are many other fascinating proposals. One involved a an office where you would never, or you didn't have to sit. You could, through the configuration of an interior design, you could lean or stand. There was a machine that built a robot that through stones and thread built a three-dimensional sculpture. There were many other kind of innovative proposals. And there were also proposals that directly for the city of Chicago. There were architects who proposed ways to fill many of the vacant lots throughout the neighborhoods with so-called infill housing. There was a very controversial proposal for locating high-rise towers east of Grant Park and moving Lakeshore Drive further east, something that I certainly was not in favor of. So, but the point here was that the architects were, the point of the biennial was that architects should have a place at the table in trying to address many of the world's critical problems, whether it's police brutality, global warming, income inequality. They don't, architects don't just design fancy, iconic museums like the Lucas Museum. They have a real role in improving quality of life in our everyday lives.
And I think that's why you care about what you do. Blair, I'm going to have to hold you right there, okay?
Absolutely. Thanks, Rick.
Blair Kamen, nationally award-winning, Pulitzer Prize-winning architectural critic for the Chicago Tribune. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Rick, my pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second half of our Sunday Spin for this morning on January 10th, 8:07 in the morning. And I'm glad that Dave mentioned that there were some flurries in the air because just outside on the Storm Center patio, and you could see a little bit of flurries. Nothing. Actually, it almost, as Bob Ferguson suggested, it's probably just snow blowing off another building or something of that nature. But it's still brutally cold out there. That wind is just roaring. And is it supposed to let up anytime soon, Dave?
Not really. Gusty winds will be around with us today, tonight, tomorrow. And that's what is helping to give those low wind chill indices. You know, temperatures falling to 14 by this afternoon, and we're there in many places right now, as a matter of fact. It's only 12 above at O'Hare, and the wind's gusting up to 30 miles an hour from the northwest, gives us a wind chill of 5 below. So, yeah, bundle up, as they say. Happy New Year.
Well, and so if you want to enjoy today's high temperature, I'd get outside now, right?
Yeah, that's right. This is as good as it gets.
This is as good as it gets. All right. Thanks, Dave. Thanks very much. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is my good friend and Tribune colleague, Bill Ruthart, member of the political team at the Chicago Tribune. And Bill is part of a political team that I don't think we've had any rest. It's nonstop. And certainly, you know, we look at last week as another point in the latest travails of Mayor Rahm Emanuel and the issue of how he initially dismissed calls that the city law department be part of a U.S. Department of Justice probe into policing and police standards in the Chicago Police Department. Obviously, all of this stretching from the Laquan McDonald video, but Emanuel kind of poo-pooed it and then found himself reversing course, pivoting, flip-flopping, whatever, to say that he would seek an independent investigation of the city's law department. This, of course, prompted by the fact that a prominent law department attorney was found by a federal judge to have been withholding exculpatory evidence that would have been beneficial to the defense. And there are other cases where this has happened as well. So, first, Bill, thanks for getting up with me this morning.
Yeah, good to be here.
And second, you know, what's the fallout from this? And here again, we see Rahm Emanuel having to react and clarify rather than kind of move forward.
Right. And to be clear, this latest issue with the law department isn't directly tied to the Laquan McDonald shooting. This was another case, a civil lawsuit involving another victim of a Chicago police shooting. And the jury in that case found that the officers were justified in the shooting, but a judge has ordered a retrial. And the reason was because he found that these city attorneys withheld evidence in the case. When the ruling came out, the city and the attorney immediately parted ways. And the next day or the day, maybe 2 days later, I don't remember exactly, you know, the mayor had his regular news conference. And, you know, we at the Tribune asked whether the mayor thought that the civil rights probe from the Justice Department, which is already looking at the police department, whether it might make sense to expand that to the city's law department, since we now have five city attorneys who have been cited by a judge for withholding evidence. And the mayor laughed at the question, believe it or not. Given all the controversy of the last couple months, he laughed at the notion and, you know, immediately tried not to answer the question. And when my colleague John Byrne pressed him on it, he finally said, no, I don't think the Justice Department should look at the law department. And
launched into a strenuous defense of Steve Patton.
Right, his top city attorney said that he would make sure this never happened again. And then the very next day after the news stories were written and the TV accounts of the press conference had gone up, the mayor had once again changed his mind, which in not necessarily on the Justice Department point of it, he said if the Justice Department can look whatever they want, I have to cooperate. He didn't ask the Justice Department to look at it, but he did say that he was going to order this quote-unquote third-party independent review of the law department. We still don't know what that means. We've been asking for details for the last few days. City Hall hasn't given us any, but presumably they're going to hire some outside law firm to, at a minimum, evaluate whether the city's law attorneys, the city attorneys and the law department have proper training on this issue. The real question is whether they're going to go back and look at these type of police misconduct cases and whether evidence has been withheld in any other cases. We certainly have two cases involving police misconduct where the same federal judge has sanctioned five city attorneys. So, you know, the mayor at first didn't seem to be concerned that there could be a widespread problem within his law department. Now he's changed his tune a little bit, mostly, again, because of the public pressure. And this is now the fourth or fifth time we've seen him reverse his stance because of the public scrutiny in these, you know, repeated scandals within his administration.
Which I think that's the thing that surprises most people, most observers, is, you know, given Emanuel's longstanding reputation as being organized, on message, a control freak, that I kind of noted that sometimes in politics, what may seem obvious becomes less obvious when it's something that a politician can't control. And frankly, that's what we've seen in these last few months, is kind of a spiraling situation of things that aren't necessarily under not necessarily something that Emanuel can control. But that having been said, the responses are, I think, what's surprising people, because it just seems to be having to make these contradictory moves to try to find his footing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for all the reputation of the political animal that he is, from everything from running the DCCC to serving in two White House administrations, there's this assumption that Rahm Emanuel knows how to react in these situations. But clearly, he's miscalculated the fallout, the depth of each of these scandals as they've come up. He has been off, and the public scrutiny and the public heat has forced him to recalibrate in every instance. You know, he stood by Gary McCarthy when they released the video, fired him a few days later because of the public fallout. He said that when they released the Laquan McDonald shooting video, he said that this was one bad rogue cop. A few days later, he's standing up and saying that anything less than total and complete reform of the Chicago Police Department with the code of silence is unacceptable. You know, in this latest case of the law department, stands by his top city attorney, says there's no need to look at it. Literally the next day says we need a third party independent review. And those are just the few examples off the top of my head. There's more. And so that is what's striking, is that, you know, for someone who always likes to portray he's in control, above the fray, even in his campaign for a second term, he was above the fray, the only adult in the room. He wasn't going to mix it up with the candidates challenging him. He is now vulnerable. He is not seen to have the steady hand that he has earlier in his administration. And it'll be interesting to see whether the Chicago City Council, along the rubber stamp for everything he wants to do, smells the blood in the water or not.
We're speaking with Bill Ruthart, my colleague on the Chicago Tribune's political team. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio. Joining me here in studio, my Chicago Tribune colleague on our political team, Bill Ruthart, and we're talking about the latest in the travails of Mayor Rahm Emanuel. And of course, now, Bill, we've got this story about the FBI looking at another Chicago police-involved shooting.
It's becoming difficult to keep track of all the police-related shootings and the issues involved. And this one, which our colleagues report on the front page of the paper this morning, involves a 2013 shooting of a gentleman named Esau Castellanos. And this gentleman was driving at like 80 miles an hour, has a car accident, a couple officers run up on the scene and open fire 19 times into the wreckage and strike this guy three times and kill him. And the story at the time, which was plastered all over the news, and was that this gentleman was armed and opened fire on the officers, and that's why they returned fire. Turned out there was no gun in the vehicle. Then the story changed that, oh, there was somebody in the vehicle with him, and now that story appears to be shaky. And the result is that apparently the FBI has been looking at this case for a couple of years now. And so part of the story is that the two officers involved in this shooting were still on the street until Friday, when the Tribune notified the Chicago Police Department that these guys were being investigated by the feds. Interim Superintendent Escalante immediately put them on desk duty, which is the procedure when they're supposed to be investigated, right, when they're being investigated. Said that this is the first they'd heard of it, but then we reported in the newspaper this morning that the city's law department and the mayor's office, as well as IPRA, the independent board that investigates police shootings, were all aware or notified that the FBI was looking into this. So why the police department seemingly didn't know and put these guys on desk duty is an open question. So, yes, this is the latest incident that is under review. FBI's had the case for 2 years. It's almost a three-year-old shooting. The FBI's taken more than a year on the Laquan McDonald situation. We know there's a grand jury there. I wonder at what point questions start being asked about the FBI and how long it's taking them to look at some of these cases.
Yeah, well, as you say, this is a couple of years. And, of course, that was one of the issues, quite frankly, that surfaced in the Laquan McDonald video and the settlement with the family about disclosure of the video and interfering with an ongoing investigation. And who knows how long these, quote, ongoing investigations can take place. And, you know, it's that issue of investigation versus transparency and transparency or lack thereof being one of the critical factors in kind of this crisis of governance that the city's going through.
Right, and certainly, you know, State's Attorney Anita Alvarez has cited time and again that the reason it took her 13 months to charge Officer Jason Van Dyke in the Laquan McDonald shooting was because the feds were also looking at the case, and she wanted to wait for them to reach their conclusion. That is the cover she is seeking as she's come under intense scrutiny in her run for another term as a state's attorney. It looks like the Democrats could endorse Kim Fox in that race, which would be a reversal of staying neutral. They're going to have a meeting this week on that issue. But certainly the involvement of the feds has been this kind of gray area that, you know, we don't really know exactly what the issues are. It could be it's taking a while because they're looking beyond just the McDonald's shooting and, right. and other people who, you know, remember, there's four other officers who filed false reports in that case. So we don't know how widespread the federal investigation is. Of course, the feds don't talk about their investigations. So that's one of these kind of unknown elements in this whole discussion.
Well, you mentioned before the break about kind of the vulnerability that Rahm Emanuel has right now. And we're seeing that in some respects in some of the very harsh rhetoric that Governor Bruce Rauner, his friend, has been leveling against the mayor, accusing him of being tone deaf to the taxpayers of Illinois, of Chicago, of being basically a failure. And all of this coming, you know, as we get even further down the road here with the lack of a state budget, with the need of the city, the public schools, mass transit of about $1 billion. We have pressing issues, obviously, with Chicago Public Schools. They need $500 million in some form of cash relief. There's the threat of a teacher strike. I tend to believe that this is, despite the harsher rhetoric, it is kind of just these guys, they know what to expect from each other. The political playbook says if you've got an opponent or want to make opponent look wounded, take advantage of them being wounded,
right,
and try to further up your score. But at the same time, as the rhetoric gets harsher, it doesn't get us any closer to fixing anything.
Right. I mean, you know, certainly Rauner, you know, took it up a notch when he did a radio interview earlier this week. It was the day after Emanuel said his law department didn't have to be looked at, and he slammed him for that and said, how tone deaf can you be, like you mentioned. And, you know, it's basically like Groundhog Day, except the comments are different each day. And now it's getting a little more heated because these guys are getting, you know, further and further down the road. You know, Rauner's comments came a day after Emanuel ribbed him by saying that his New Year's resolution for Rauner is that he'll pass a budget before he has to give a budget address for his second budget in February. So, it's not a second budget if you never pass the first budget. So, you know, these guys, there's some talk that, oh, that's gotten really bad. And you know, I'm not sure I buy that. These guys know the game, especially Emanuel. Maybe Rauner is takes it more personally. I don't think Emanuel does. I think he knows the game of politics. These guys still communicate quite often. But you're right. It doesn't get anybody any closer. You got these issues at the city with CPS in dire need of some $500 million to avoid further cuts. He's got the teachers union preparing to strike. I mean, the mess just keeps on coming from Rahm Emanuel.
I thought one thing that was striking, though, was when Rauner basically and Emanuel had been kind of looked at as a potential bridge between Mike Madigan, the Speaker of the House, and Governor Rauner, the two of them at longtime loggerheads, that Rahm being could kind of maybe facilitate between both of them. But then you have Rauner accusing Emanuel of hiding behind Speaker Madigan and not wanting to upset the Speaker.
Yeah, I mean, I think the easiest way to explain this is like envision a triangle, you know. At the top, you have Madigan. At one point of the triangle, you have Emanuel and Cullerton. And then the other, you have the governor. And, you know, I don't see Emanuel bridging much of anything in that triangle. He's close to Senate President Cullerton. But at the end of the day, it's Madigan and it's Rauner. And I'm not sure, given Rahm's issues in the city, that he's in much of a position to broker a whole heck of a lot in Springfield.
And frankly, there is no brokering going on in Springfield. So we have the House was scheduled to be in session this week, and that's now been put off. And lawmakers from the House not scheduled to be back until late January. Bill Ruthart, my colleague from the Chicago Tribune's political team, thanks for getting up with me this morning. I appreciate it.
Anytime.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, State Representative Mike Zalewski, Democrat from Riverside, will be talking about his proposal to legitimize and legalize the issue of fantasy sports in Illinois.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. My friends at the Literacy Volunteers of Illinois asked if I could remind everybody that the 25th Annual Tutor and Adult Learner Conference on the Road to Literacy is coming up on Saturday, April 9th. I know that sounds like a ways away, but they're very orderly, this group, and they wanted me to mention that. And it's a great conference, several workshops, and you can find more information and register for this. Just go to their website, lvillinois.org. And look for the On the Road to Literacy Conference. It's their 25th annual conference. So you'll be hearing me talk about that more in the upcoming weeks. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is State Representative Mike Zalewski, Democrat from Riverside, who is the lead sponsor of legislation, should the House ever decide to reconvene, of legislation that would essentially legalize the issue of fantasy sports in Illinois. And of course, we had Lisa Madigan's opinion that came out that said that it is a form of illegal gambling in the state. Representative, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
One question I have, since she issued this opinion, why can you still play fantasy sports in Illinois?
So the Attorney General in Illinois, her opinions are advisory in nature. They're not like Attorney General Schneiderman's in New York, and she doesn't have quite the same powers as the Massachusetts Attorney General. That being said, she interprets current law as daily fantasy sports being illegal. So under the existing law, her opinion exposed players to criminal liability. The operators went to court for a declaratory judgment, and their attorneys and her attorneys came to an agreement where they'd give the legislature probably about 6 months to June 27th to come up with some sort of policy solution. So that's where we are now. Everyone can continue to play until June 27th, and it's probably incumbent upon the General Assembly to figure it out by then.
So in the interest of full disclosure, one of my daughters works for a company that has a component that is a fantasy sports component. And obviously we've seen these companies explode. And you can't not see an ad for them anywhere, on a bus,
right,
on a, you know, on TV. I have to tell you, I've never played. What's the deal?
So daily fantasy is a little different than season-long fantasy. In daily fantasy, you sign up through your phone or through the computer, and you pay a fee, and you're allowed to enter sort of a pool. And you pick a lineup based on who you think is going to perform well that day. The NFL is the easiest example because they play every week, and everyone kind of gets fantasy football. You're allotted a salary, and you have to pick the players you think are going to perform the best statistically in that week. You have the key in daily fantasy, the trick is to pick the players that nobody else picks, because you have to allot your salary appropriately. So, in other words, everyone's going to pick Rob Gronkowski. Everybody's going to pick Tom Brady. You have to pick the quarterback that's going to have that great game that nobody else had. That's the idea behind daily fantasy. Whoever accrues the most points wins the prize pool at the end of the day. Now, there's a lot of things in daily fantasy world that are murky at best. We have to deal with how we're going to, you know, align these lineup aggregators and people that enter these algorithms in the computer. But ultimately, it's incumbent upon the player to decide if they want to risk that money and try to beat another guide who can pick that best lineup.
So, I mean, one of the issues in gambling laws is skill versus chance.
Right.
And the skill being to pick the right player, but then there is a chance factor. As you said, you're looking for that player who's going to maybe have that breakout game that hasn't had one that nobody else is going to pick.
Correct.
So how do you kind of navigate through this in your legislation?
Well, the Attorney General's opinion, I think, lays out the issues incredibly well. She ultimately came to the conclusion that daily fantasy sports doesn't fit within we have exceptions in the Illinois gambling law. We have exceptions for going on a riverboat casino. We have exceptions for playing horse racing. What the daily fantasy operators had said was we fit in one of these exceptions. She disagreed, and there's arguments on both sides. I wasn't surprised by her opinion. I ultimately think that she says in the closing paragraph, the legislature has to act here. They have to create if they want these sites to continue to operate in Illinois, they have to create a clear and concise exception for daily fantasy sports. And it's incumbent upon them to do it, because under current law, I don't think it's okay to play these sites going forward.
Well, indeed, you were exploring this legislation even before she came out with that opinion.
Right.
Because of the murkiness of the issue.
Exactly.
One of the things I'm curious about, and we saw this earlier among some of the major players in this, was the whole issue of employees of mm-hmm. these companies and playing each other's games or whatever kind of thing. And now, ostensibly, that's been banned by right. self-regulation. But what about some kind of comprehensive regulation? You know, you look at, you know, the gaming board and issues of background checks, those kinds of things. Shouldn't we have that kind of a thing for these people?
Well, what my bill does is several things. It creates that exception in gambling law to legalize it. It also starts from a premise of best practices. So what we tried to do was codify what we would consider best practices for these sites to operate. We would want them to make sure underage players weren't playing. We would want them to protect the money once someone deposits their initial entry fee into the account. We would want to make sure that there's a proper screening if anyone is owing child support to another parent, that money comes out first. Now, there's been a good faith argument made that my bill is too light on these operators, and I understand that. And we have a lot of work to do in the General Assembly to convince a lot of people that we need, you know, probably some good objective set of eyes on this to see what we can do to strengthen the bill. But my ultimate goal, I think, was to put forth a best practices bill that would be a good place to have a conversation, and then we can go from there, and I can try to convince my colleagues. If they have input, they want to say this doesn't go far enough, come to me, mark up the bill, and we'll have these conversations. But I wanted to have a good starting point so that we could have a conversation going forward on what we can do to protect players while at the same time allowing people to enjoy the sites.
What, in the conversations you've had with some of your colleagues, I mean, what are you finding here?
I mean,
a recognition that this should be legal?
Yeah, I was at an event I introduced a bill on a Wednesday, and I went to an event with my colleagues on a Thursday night, and there's about 30 of us there. And I had to walk through what daily fantasy sports was, just like I did a minute ago with you. That was probably one half of the hour, 45 minutes of the hour, or an hour long. And then the other half was either people saying, I love fantasy sports. This is the best thing you could have done, was make sure that these guys are continuing to operate in Illinois. And the other half of the conversation was, oh, I'm so sick of the ads. Make sure you come down hard on these guys. Like, I was spraying to all fields, and you know, no one had really wrapped their arms around what the bill was. So I have a lot of work to do in terms of convincing people this is a good consumer protection bill, but at the same time convincing people this is something that their constituents want. You know, we put out an online petition. We asked for some grassroots support because I think, you know, people – it came out in Uber a couple years ago, and it's coming out now. People don't like the government shutting down popular technologies. I mean, we live on phones right now. And people enjoy their phones and maybe to an unhealthy degree. But
thank you. I would chime in on that.
But ultimately, government has to start reconciling itself that technology is spinning way ahead of what we can catch up to. So rather than trying to ban it or shove it out of the way, let's just try to reconcile ourselves with it and put some consumer protections on the books and go forward from there.
We're speaking with State Representative Mike Zalewski, Democrat from Riverside, a member of the General Assembly, first elected in 2008. And we're talking about his legislation to formally legalize fantasy sports, daily fantasy sports in Illinois. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin on this chilly Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio with State Representative Mike Zalewski, Democrat from Riverside. We're talking about his legislation that would formally legalize fantasy sports in Illinois. We have a agreement between the firms, and this is, we're talking about big business. I mean, you've got some of the pro leagues are investors in this.
The networks, the cable networks, there's a lot of people involved in these sites.
Well, given the big money apparently seen here, what about taxing? What about taxation issues?
You know, we've had that conversation numerous times now. I continue to say we can't even begin to try to tax this or to have that discussion until we wrap our arms around what it is. It's one of the criticisms I think it's rightfully so in Springfield is we always try to tax something before we always put the cart before the horse on the revenue discussion. I really truly think that if we can put a good law on the books and make it consumer friendly and make sure that everyone's concerns are assuaged and at the same time keep the technology operating in Illinois, I think my colleagues will weigh in and they'll want to probably see a revenue discussion being had. But right now my focus is on good regulatory policy. Ultimately, I know that conversation on revenue has to be had, but my focus right now has to be squarely on what can we do to bring these guys, keep these sites operating in Illinois.
Keep them into some kind of compliance.
Correct.
I mean, part of me looks at that $1.3 billion Powerball jackpot and going, maybe the state should just invest some money in some tickets here, and we might be able to cover a few things here with a lack of a budget. But, I mean, certainly I've got to figure there is a bit of pushback from existing gambling interests in Illinois, the riverboats, the video poker guys, kind of thing.
So far, not publicly, Rick. I mean, they might privately have been saying, like, this is, we don't want the market competition. It's important to remember that, like we talked about earlier, this technology is not designed to be competitive with video poker at your neighborhood tavern or craps tables at the riverboats. It's designed to be played on your couch watching football, hockey, basketball, and baseball. It's designed to be a running mate to watching sports. So I don't think that they
almost a form of social media.
Yeah, almost a form of social media. Exactly. They shouldn't view it as competition. If they do, that's regrettable. And I'm not naive to think they won't. But my hope is that they realize that there's different demographics for these things, and the demographic for daily fantasy sports, to me, is wildly different than a lottery player playing a Powerball ticket or someone going to a neighborhood tavern and playing video poker.
You mean just the younger demographic?
Yeah, younger sports fans, statistically motivated. You know, you don't. The theory behind daily fantasy is, and again, we have to reconcile some of the data that's come out about these lineup aggregators and these statistical models being put in. But ultimately, the theory is I watch enough football, I watch enough basketball, I pay attention enough to the stats to think that I have at least a reasonable chance of doing better than the guy watching the same game across town. So that's different than thinking you can beat the house at blackjack or thinking that you can put $5 in the video poker machine and get that straight flush.
It's how everybody can is better than the analysts that you watch.
Well, everyone thinks we know who's going to have a good game that day.
I want to turn our attention in the closing minutes here to Springfield.
Sure.
And, you know, obviously, as I mentioned, the House was supposed to be in, and now that's been pushed back to, I think, January 23rd.
State of the state. on the 2 weeks from Wednesday.
Yeah. So, I mean, one is even to get that legislation moving is it's not going to happen anytime soon. But two, and you were here listening to my conversation with Bill Ruthart from the Tribune about this, the escalation of rhetoric going on between Governor Rauner and Mayor Emanuel. And I think you tend to disagree with Mr. Ruthart and I that these are two guys that the rhetoric really doesn't matter, that, you know, even though the deepening of it, I think, does kind of point to where do we go next here?
Well, I think the governor continues to be frustrated, and he was elected to be a change agent and to change the trajectory of the state government. And I think he's frustrated that by and large, majorities, both Republican and Democrats in both chambers, just do not align with some of the turnaround items that he wants to see become law. I mean, he has the opportunity to sign a privatization of DECO bill. He would have had the opportunity to do a workers' compensation law that would have brought a causation standard to Illinois for the first time. He would have had the opportunity to freeze property taxes for 2 years. Those are all things that I would have considered to be good first steps in a Republican governor's first year in this state. Ultimately, he has a different viewpoint on that, and I respect it, but we need a budget. And as long as there continues to be this focus on things that ultimately I don't think he's ever going to see 60 votes in the House and 30 votes in the Senate on, we're going to be in this stalemate. Now, we can go down to Springfield and continue to yell at ourselves, at each other, and have votes where some vote yes, some vote present, some vote no. But that's not a good return on investment for taxpayers. If the governor doesn't want to see revenue in a budget until he gets his turnaround items, then we should just do a budget without revenue. But we need a budget, and we need to move forward from this stalemate that we're in right now.
But aren't we in so deep now, approaching 7 months without a budget for this budget year, that to do a budget without revenue, we can't do?
Well, I think you're seeing fiscal. You've got fiscal year 16's budget. You've seen what's risen to the surface of ability for the state to pay. Now, it's a lousy budget, and it's nothing anyone in the General Assembly can be proud of. But we're on this autopilot, and the lapse period between the time we're going to be able to pay our bills and the time that the bills come in with the controller is going to be awful. And eventually, we're going to start that lapse period may become unbearable. But, you know, higher ed hasn't been funded for fiscal year 16. There's a real good chance that truth may become reality. There's a lot of social service providers that have been contractually obligated to pay to do their services that are not getting paid. That's a budget reality. We've got fiscal year 16 budget, regrettably, almost done. We've got to move on almost to fiscal year 17 at this point.
Well, and of course, that's what we're kind of looking at, is the governor getting ready to prepare a fiscal 2017 budget. Is this maybe a good time to consider maybe we do budgeting for 2 years instead of 1 year in this state?
I think we ultimately, when the final deal is reached, we will have done a 2-year budget.
But make it consistent.
Make it consistent, sure. We have a lot of work to do in budgeting in Illinois. A 2-year budget is something that certainly should be considered to make sure we never have to go through this again.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah, right.
We'll see. And quite frankly, you know, as I've said before, people are looking at November to sew up 2016 and you know, perhaps 2017, because of now we've entered the political year, and I don't see how the dynamics make it that much easier to get anything done.
They don't.
Some heartening words there from State Representative Mike Zalewski, Democrat from Riverside. Thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Rick.
We'll be back with more right after this. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, Blair Kamen and Bill Ruthart from the Chicago Tribune, and State Representative Mike Zalewski. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening on this very, very chilly Sunday morning. And Dean Richards, I got to tell you, I didn't even get a chance to get into the El Chapo Sean Penn matter.
How crazy is that? Sean Penn hanging out with El Chapo.
And apparently fancying himself as a journalist by writing a piece for Rolling Stone about this.
He's a talented storyteller, so that much I'll give him. What in the world is Sean Penn hanging out with Public Enemy number one for?
Well, it to me, it just got weirder. As one, you know, you had the arrest. Then it was he was arrested in part because he wanted to have a movie made about him.
Right.
And then we go to the next step. Here's Sean Penn.
May have been how the cops were able to trace back to him by following the stench of Sean Penn. I don't mean that literally.
Actually,
following the trail.
Right. Well, someone,
if he was aromatic that day, I don't know.
Now someone tweeted that, you know, 20 years from now, we'll learn that Sean Penn was really a
operative
of the U.S.
Wow.
government. Someone else suggested that El Chapo was actually poised to have been arrested earlier, but that arrest was delayed because Sean Penn was in the compound.
It's all above my pay grade, I'm afraid. I'm worried about the Golden Globes today. That's what I'm worried about.
Fair enough.
We're going to talk about that coming up later on today in fascinating interviews. You'll actually be really interested in this, Rick. We talked with the actors, but also some of the real people who were involved on the attack of the U.S. compound in Benghazi.
Wow.
There's a film that's coming out next week called 13 Days. John Krasinski, directed by Michael Bay. We talked with both of them. You'll hear those later on. But actually, three of the former U.S. Navy SEALs who were in the compound
Wow.
defending it. Fascinating conversation. We'll get to that coming up